court is ready for argument in State of Minnesota versus Scott Germscheid. Is that how it's pronounced?
Germscheid.
I apologize. Appellate counsel may take the podium and begin argument. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Joe Tamburino, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Germscheid. Your Honors, I'm going to concentrate on two issues in this case. First, that it was an abuse of discretion by the trial court for not admitting the victim, ASG's 911 call on May 14th, 2017. And second, that it was also an abuse of discretion by allowing ASG's statements through Ms. Solomon. The rest I will rest on the brief. First, in terms of the 911 call, I would just like to set the scene as it was shown in the record. ASG at the time was 7 years old. It was, 8 years old. It was May 15th, 2017. And we were there on a trial day, myself and Mr. Hajdukovic, who was the trial attorney, as I was. And what was disclosed that happened a day before was that on May 14th, 2017, ASG, while he was with Ms. Larson, made a 911 call stating that he was being assaulted or some type of criminal activity against him involving his dad. We then disclosed this to the state, and as Minsis and the record clearly shows, the trial was continued. We requested discovery of the 911 call, and that was given to us. Mr. Hajdukovic gave that to us. So that's the scene of what happened. Then, at the time of the action.
How significant is it that that occurred a year after the incident here?
Extremely significant, because it was on the eve of trial. Trial was May 15th, 2017. The parties were there, and the day before, this evidence was presented to us, where the child, outside of the home, not forced outside, he was just staying with a friend, while my client, Mr. Germscheid, was not present, had a complete alibi, made this 911 call.
But we are examining the credibility as of April 2016, are we not?
That is correct. But credibility is something that is not in a time capsule. It's not credibility must be judged at the time that someone was making a report of a crime. Credibility is something that is completely fluid, and it is relevant to when the actual witness testifies. Whether or not a witness testifies and is found to be untruthful the day before or 2 years before is relevant as to credibility, regardless of whether or not the person actually gives testimony. Like in this case, ASG was found to be incompetent, but his statements were still put in the record, as we know.
And who did you say ASG was with when he made this call?
Ms. Kelly Larson.
And she was?
She was a friend of the family. You see, as the record
So isn't the kind of the issue whether he was reporting that there currently was an assault or something had happened to him in the past?
No, currently. What he said on the 911 call is clear. The state disclosed it to us. He said that his dad is there fighting with his girlfriend, and that's not correct. That was incorrect. So what happened at the trial, obviously, is we requested the trial court judge to allow us to call Ms. Larson and admit into evidence what had occurred in order to attack ASG's credibility, even though he was not testifying. And the reason for that is all of the other statements of ASG through Ms. Terpstra, who was the school social worker, and Ms. Solomon, who was the child protection social worker or child protection agent. And so that's why we made that motion. And what we argued to the district court, to Judge Caligiuri, is that obviously what we argued to the district court, to Judge Ekstrom, is obviously this is going to the credibility of the person who's making these allegations, ASG. The court obviously declined to do that, and one of the things that we argued was the Spiegel case. And the Spiegel case is an unpublished case that both parties have referenced, and obviously we've attached that. And the Spiegel case is directly on point, even though unpublished. I was the trial court attorney in the Spiegel case. It was in front of Judge Caligiuri, 2013 in Hennepin County. And what we argued at the time was that in the Spiegel case, my client was accused of pointing a gun at someone in a Lund's parking lot in 2013. The person who made the allegation by the initials DB was someone, through our investigation, that we found out made a very similar allegation against another individual 12 years earlier in 2001. And we argued that that is exonerating evidence. It goes to the credibility of the declarant, the alleged victim, DB in that case, and it should be admitted. We also, obviously, with the Goldenstein case. The trial court disagreed with us, and we have used that case now because a colleague of ours took that case on appeal, and this court reversed District Court Judge Caligiuri. This court clearly said in the Spiegel case that when there is a probability that a person is lying, there was a false report of a crime, that that may be admissible. And the Spiegel case was one where the false report of a crime was 12 years prior to our trial date in 2013. In this matter, what we have is ASG, the victim in this case, who's making a false report the day before trial, and we weren't allowed to explore that. Now,
well, in the earlier case, Mr. Tamburino, the court said it was a balancing test.
Correct.
And the court in this instance that we're reviewing felt that doing that balancing test, that the factors did not weigh in your favor, in essence. Why is that an abuse of discretion?
And with all due respect to the trial court, it is an abuse of discretion because our evidence had more weight and had more credibility than even the evidence we had in the Spiegel case. In the Spiegel case, recall, that was an allegation that was 12 years prior to our case. Additionally, in the Spiegel case, the declarant, the alleged victim, DB, supposedly said, well, back then, 12 years ago, it looked like he might have had a gun. And that's what the state argued in that case, and that's what District Court Judge Caligiuri found, was that, well, he said he might have had a gun. That's not really, certain. But this court said, well, the other individuals who we were not allowed to call in the Spiegel case clearly said in that statement that they were accused of pointing a gun, and that was not true. And the police investigated, and there were no charges. Our case has better facts. Our case has a child who always remained with my client. He was never taken out of the home. There was no child protection issue. There were no CHIPS actions. He was never taken out of the home. And we have this case where, after the alleged incident and before, on the eve of trial, the alleged victim states to a 911 caller that a crime is being committed against him or there's some argument with his dad, and it's completely false. And we were not able to show that to the court because Judge Ekstrom stated, well, it's a balancing test, and Your Honor is right, and you haven't met that. And that was an abuse of discretion because the evidence we had in this case was much greater than Spiegel. That's why that, as we can see on page 48, I believe, of the transcripts, that's why I believe it's 48, that's why the May 15th, 2017 jury trial date was continued to investigate this claim. And that's why Mr. Hadukovich disclosed to us in time and totally appropriately, that 911 transcript, that recording, because it was that important. And it was abuse of discretion that the trial court did not allow us to do that. As we see on pages, I believe, 43 to 49, we argued quite a bit to have this evidence admitted. And the trial court took a brief recess, came back, and said, well, we just haven't met the burden. And speaking of the burden, I would like to address one issue. The prosecution, Mr. Hadukovich, in his brief stated that, well, we have waived this issue because we didn't say anything about the balancing test. And I apologize that we did not mention that. But that's not a waiver of issue. The case that the state cites is the Patterson case, which is clearly where a defendant did a waiver of a Blakely issue, didn't raise it on appeal, and then in his reply brief said, well, I didn't do an adequate waiver of Blakely. So the Patterson case is about, look, you submitted your brief, you gave us the issues, the state came back and said, you never raised an issue about Blakely, and now you're raising it in the reply brief. That is an issue that was never raised. We have raised that issue. We have completely argued that what the 911 call was about should have been admitted into evidence. It would be as if a defendant objected to Spiegel evidence, and as we know, five parts to Spiegel: notice, particular acts, clear and convincing, relevant, and probative value is not outweighed by prejudice. And then in the brief, they missed number five. They didn't mention number five in the brief about probative value. But they still objected to the evidence, and they still went through all of the analysis. So we have not raised that issue. Then, Your Honors, in terms of the second issue, and that's the district court abused its discretion by admitting ASG's out-of-court statements through Ms. Solomon. And I'd like to set the scene for that. On April 7th, I believe, 2016, ASG was in second grade. He was 7 years old. He uses the bathroom in the health office. At the health office were two people, a paraprofessional and the social worker for the school district, Ms. Terpstra. When he walks in, the paraprofessional notices that there's a bruise on his ear, alerts Ms. Terpstra, who then starts talking to ASG to find out what happened. And then the following day, ASG, starts giving statements to Ms. Solomon. Now, Ms. Solomon is a child protection worker through Washington County. The defense, we did not object to the statements by ASG made to the paraprofessional or Ms. Terpstra. Why? Because those were not testimonial. As we know through Ohio v. Clark, testimonial is basically when you're trying to recreate or gather facts in an investigation to see what happened in the past. Non-testimonial is when you're just trying to assess basically an emergency situation. In Clark, it was about a teacher who noticed something with the pupil, and they were questioning the pupil right there. Same in this case with the paraprofessional and Ms. Terpstra. There was no objection to what ASG said in those situations, because in the nurse's office, they were trying to assess what happened to him. Who did this? What happened to your ear? These are normal questions. But rather, the next day, Ms. Solomon, and the record is clear on this, she works as child protection worker. She had communicated with Bayport Police. In fact, she communicated, as the record has shown, with Mr. Hajdukovich at some point about whether or not they should also issue a CHIPS petition. The child was not removed from the home. In fact, if you look at Mr. Germscheid's testimony, and it was undisputed, the child remained with him the whole time. There was no CHIPS action. He would bring the child to meetings with different types of therapists. It's all in the record. But Ms. Solomon acted more than just to see what's happening in this emergency situation. Rather, she was gathering facts, trying to see what happened in the past, in her family assessment. And she's clear about this. What does she do in a family assessment? She talks to the parties, obviously the dad, other people, the victim. She does an actual assessment in the case, and she interviews and consults with others. Who does she consult with, as she stated? Bayport Police and Mr. Hajdukovich. Ms. Terpstra doesn't go to Mr. Hajdukovich's office and says, what are we gonna do, CHIPS or a criminal charge? She's a social worker for the school who is basically trying to find out what happened to this child at the time. Ms. Solomon is someone different. Regardless that she's not a licensed peace officer, she is someone who consults with the authorities as the assessment is going on. She said so on her testimony, Bayport Police and Mr. Hajdukovich's office. That becomes testimonial because at that point you have an agent of the state who is not assessing an emergency situation, who's not saying, what's happening right now? Can this child go back home? Like Ms. Terpstra, it's quite different. Ms. Solomon is trying to gain in an assessment what happened in the past in order to do an assessment, consult with the police, and consult with the prosecutor's office. That's a different position. And so the statements by ASG to Ms. Solomon were testimonial. And of course, their admission is not harmless error.
Everything. Can I just ask you, is it your argument that, the school social worker has the conversation. She, being a mandatory reporter, talks to the county social worker. And that individual then, Ms. Solomon, interviews the child the following day.
Correct.
And so are you taking the position that any part of that interview then was done for purposes of prosecution?
In this case, yes. And the reason why is because think of what would happen if you just change the facts a little bit. Ms. Solomon, the child is not allowed to go home after talking to Ms. Terpstra. They hold the child. It's an emergency hold. And Ms. Solomon, within the 12 or 18 hours, goes to interview the child because this is an ongoing emergency. We don't know what's happening. That would not be testimonial. But in a case like this, where the child is home, there is no ongoing emergency, and the social worker through the county, Child Protection, comes in and now basically does an investigation and communicates actively with the police, that is testimonial. I believe both parties cited the Ahmed case for different reasons, but the Ahmed case is interesting. My time is up. Thank you.
Could discuss it on rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Nicholas Hajdukovic. I'm an assistant Washington County attorney, and I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota. This court should affirm the appellant's conviction for malicious punishment of a child. And as Mr. Tamburino did, I'll concentrate as well on the issues of whether the district court abused its discretion by excluding a 911 call and also the admissibility of ASG's statements to the social worker, Ms. Solomon. With regard to the 911 audio, I first want to note, as I stand here today, I'm not certain that the actual audio is in the record in this case. It may be, I just don't know as I stand here today. But what I would submit is that if it is not, the appellant or the party seeking admission of statements under the Goldenstein and Spiegel cases has the burden of showing a reasonable probability that the statements that they seek to admit are in fact false. And so if the 911 call was not submitted, and there's only brief discussion that I see in the transcript at pages 44 and 48 of the motion hearing of what the call says, then that's a failure of the appellant to meet their burden, and that in itself indicates a non-abuse of discretion by the district court. The Spiegel case, again unpublished, defines reasonable probability adopting a Minnesota Supreme Court definition as that it's sufficient to undermine confidence in the outcome. And the actual 911 call doesn't report that ASG was being assaulted by anybody. What it basically says is that his mom and dad, and it's later qualified that he doesn't actually mean mom in the biological sense, are fighting, and that they sometimes are arguing. I would submit that I think based on the record in this case that that's not demonstrably false. And it's probably not something that's capable of actually being proven false. The statements in the 911 call are very vague, and I don't think that there's something that it can be simply called false and admitted because they're so vague. If the 911 call is in the record, what you'll hear is that the ASG is whispering throughout the 911 call and making statements and is sort of cagey about what's going on. And it's true that from the record, it appears he was not at home at the time, but he says, mom and dad fight a lot, basically, and sometimes they argue. No specific time frame.
But because the standard of review is abuse of discretion, what was the district court's reasoning on that exclusion?
The district court's reasoning was that the appellant did not meet their burden of showing a reasonable probability that the statements were false.
I understand that, but did the district court explain why or what his thinking was?
I don't think there was much elaboration on it. I think it was just a general statement that I'm not convinced, based on the record before me, that a reasonable likelihood exists that the statements were false. And based on everything I've just said, I don't think that that's an abuse of discretion to say that, whether it's because there really isn't enough evidence in the record to say that, or even if the 911 call is actually in the record. It's not something that, when you actually listen to what it says, is something that's easily proven being false, because it's very vague, and it sounds like a child who's basically crying out for help, who's in a bad situation at home, was my interpretation of it throughout. But it's not something that would reflect on credibility because it's not obviously false or even really capable of being proven false, is what I would submit.
It sounds like it could potentially hurt the defense.
Yes, I think it actually quite possibly could have hurt the defense. I mean, we would have had to put a lot of context in, and it probably would have sidetracked the trial a bit, but I do think that it's not something that would look favorable in front of a jury, certainly. So for that reason alone, I'd submit that the district court didn't abuse its discretion if the court does reach the merits of this issue and finds that it wasn't forfeited by how it was phrased in appellant's principal brief. With regard to the second issue, the confrontation clause issue, What I would submit to the court is that under the facts and circumstances of this case, Ms. Solomon's questioning of ASG was not something that was done with the primary purpose of obtaining evidence for the use in criminal prosecution. What the Supreme Court said in the Ohio v. Clark case is that the statement, they phrased it a few different ways, but their ultimate conclusion is that the statement of the child is not testimonial because there is no indication that the primary purpose of the conversation was to gather evidence for Clark's prosecution. What I would note is that in most scenarios, since Crawford, the Supreme Court has been narrowing the scope of what's testimonial under the Confrontation Clause, with some exceptions, like testimony about forensic testing and things like that that aren't applicable here. But I think that that phrasing, no indication that the primary purpose was to gather evidence for Clark's prosecution, is really important here. And obviously, the court has to look at the totality of the circumstances to determine what Ms. Solomon's primary purpose was here.
Could you respond to, we know that this was the day after the initial observation of these bruises, and it was not done at the police station. What is there evidence in the record of these contacts between Solomon and the law enforcement or yourself?
Well, I would, first of all, with regard to myself, no. And that's because there was no contact with me because she would have been talking with somebody in my office's juvenile division, presumably about whether to file a CHIPS petition. I believe that there was, I believe that there are some statements in, it's Exhibit 1, I believe, to a letter that I submitted to the district court on September 15th of 2017, essentially laying out the state's arguments for admissibility, and I included in that Ms. Solomon's summary, her case assessment. And that included basically everything she did in the case, and there are references, I believe, to contact with the county attorney's office to determine essentially what the next step would be, if there would be any legal proceedings brought or not. But I don't think that that's dispositive and even necessarily that important in the analysis. I mean, certainly it's something the court can consider, but what Ms. Solomon's actions actually demonstrate throughout her assessment show, reflect on her primary purpose and show that, like the teacher in Clark, her primary purpose was to ensure that ASG's safety. And the primary argument that I have here is that if you look at the steps laid out in 626.556 for family assessments, Ms. Solomon basically followed those to a T. And that statute indicates that, first of all, the public policy of the state is to obviously protect children and promote child safety and provide a family assessment in situations like this. And it defines a family assessment as a comprehensive assessment of child safety, risks of child maltreatment, and family strengths and needs. And it does not include even a determination of whether maltreatment occurred. And so basically what the statute directs a social worker conducting the assessment to do is go out and look at everything going on in this kid's life and figure out, is this kid safe at home? And that's what Ms. Solomon did. She was acting as a social worker here, not as a police officer or as an agent of the police officer or as an assistant to a police officer. Though they do cross-report with each other statutorily, it's ultimately the social services agency that decides, for example, whether to do a family assessment or a family investigation, which have very different requirements. And the statute also requires the social services agency to conduct a face-to-face contact with the child reported to be maltreated and the child's primary caregiver sufficient to complete a safety assessment and ensure the immediate safety of the child. So here, Ms. Solomon spoke with ASG after receiving the report. She then, according to her case assessment, which is part of the record, spoke with a nurse at Midwest Children's Resource Center and showed the nurse photos that she had taken of the child's injuries, learned that they were concerning for child abuse. Next spoke with the son of the appellant's girlfriend who also lived in the household. She spoke with appellant about what had happened that day, but also about the child's general behavioral issues, medications, discipline, things that you would expect a social worker to talk to somebody about in a situation like this. And then later on after that, she speaks with the appellant and ASG together about how things are going. She's doing home visits. How are you guys doing? Making observations. She provides information about programming to the appellant, things like domestic violence programming, anger management. She makes a referral for an in-home parent skills worker to come work in their home with them to help them out and makes recommendations for future actions. And basically says, because ultimately The appellant is cooperating with the assessment that there was no need to have institute legal proceedings like a CHIPS petition. That's, first of all, what I think we want a social worker to do, but moreover, it demonstrates that she doesn't have this primary purpose of getting evidence to prosecute the appellant. And in fact, I'd note that it's often encouraged to minimize the number of interviews of a child victim by having one interview by social services and law enforcement, and that didn't even happen in this case. There were different interviews by law enforcement and by social services, further demonstrating that she's not just working as an agent of law enforcement. It's very different than the Bobadilla case that the appellant cites, where the social worker was quite literally acting at the behest of law enforcement. They asked her to conduct an interview of the victim, and as they concluded, she was simply acting as an agent of the police. Here, this is completely different, and she was acting, although she worked with the police and with the county attorney's office as statutorily required, that by no means indicates her primary purpose is to gather evidence so that the appellant can be criminally prosecuted. Those are very different things. With regard to the residual hearsay exception, that's the second prong, I guess, of the admissibility. I submit the district court, again, didn't abuse its discretion in its findings that the statements were admissible. The district court cited to the Ahmed case that counsel was about to bring up and said that basically the statement satisfied those factors sufficiently to show general indicia of reliability. And there are findings, including that the statements were made spontaneously, things of that nature. And the record really demonstrates that these statements, other than the initial statements where the child basically said his father told him to lie about what happened, are consistent with each other, further demonstrating their reliability. They're made in response to open-ended questions. There's no evidence in the record to the contrary about that. And so the state would submit that there simply was no abuse of discretion in finding that the statement satisfied the residual hearsay exceptions. That satisfies what I wanted to talk about with the court today on those two issues. Unless the court has additional questions, I would simply ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. A number of points. First, going back to the Ahmed case with the Sixth Amendment issue. The Ahmed facts are very telling because in Ahmed, the alleged victim who was a child, the initials are H.A., and he was taken to Corner House and never gave a statement. And so then on one particular day, the Corner House people asked his grandmother, F.B., who he confides in and it seemed to love, gets there at Corner House. And in the lobby, the child runs to his grandmother. Grandmother says, "What happens?" And he says, "The person who did it, Mr. Ahmed." Not even in the Corner House interview. And then later, when he went into the interview, he didn't say anything again. And what the Ahmed court said was this. In Ahmed, that statement to the grandmother is non-testimonial. And Ahmed was very interesting. It said, basically, if the Corner House interview were to have taken place at the officer's behest, where the officers, police officers, got the victim to Corner House, that would be a separate issue. But what we're talking about here is the child saying this to his grandmother in the lobby. Same thing in our case. Ms. Terpstra, no problem with the statements to her. Ongoing emergency, want to find out what's going on. Child goes home, not taken out of the home. To Ms. Solomon, she's doing more. And what is she doing more? You could give her 1,000 things to do, but out of that 1,000, one of them is working with the police, is working with the authorities, and gaining information. And I would point out on page, 86 of the trial transcript, she did say that there was a phone conversation, lines 7 through basically 14, phone conversation with the county attorney's office. She says on question line 10, "I apologize." The question is this. "I apologize. Did you have a conversation with Mr. Hajdukovic and his witness coordinator, Ms. Valentin, on May 2nd? I believe that was the date." And on page 88, there is the mention that she works, on page 88, lines 5 through 10, Ms. Solomon admits that she cross-reports the initial report that comes in with the Bayport Police. So it's clear that that happens. Second, with the 911 call, that information does not hurt the defense. We wanted that information in because, as was stated in our offer of proof on page 44 of the transcript, Austin called 911 reporting that his father and his stepmother, who was the defendant's girlfriend at the time, were fighting and that he felt fearful and he wanted the Bayport police to respond to his home. During that incident, Austin was not at home. It was the weekend before the trial setting. This was completely made up, and then it goes on and on. It was clear that Austin was not home, reporting that his dad and girlfriend or stepmother were fighting, and he wanted the police to come. He wasn't even at home. We were going to be able to establish that. Additionally, on page 46 of the transcript, Mr. Hajdukovic himself is unsure as to the credibility of this 911 call. I point from lines 5 through 12, Mr. Hajdukovic's argument to the court against the admission of the 911. Well, then the state ought to be able to show, if it can, perhaps in rebuttal, that there's not that that's not true. And we end up calling numerous other witnesses to show that maybe Austin was telling the truth. But then he says, maybe this just this 911 call was just a cry for help from a child who was in a terrible situation at home. I mean, frankly, that's the state's theory about it. He's questioning the credibility of his witness in that 911 call. Maybe it's not that he actually needed assistance or that he felt scared. Maybe it's just a cry for help. Well, that's true. Maybe it was. And we should be able to have shown the jury that he made a fictitious 911 call about his dad being there and fighting with stepmom when the dad wasn't even present, and we can completely prove that. Thank you, Your Honor. And for those reasons, we would ask to reverse.
Thank you. Thank you for the arguments and briefing. The case is submitted.